We are following some breaking news overnight in Missouri. A pipeline explosion rocked the small town of Houstonia. It's about 75 miles west of Kansas City. Officials say there was a rupture at a compressor. A spokeswoman for the Panhandle Eastern Pipeline Company says there were no fatalities or injuries. The cause is still under investigation.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3. Two, one.
Injection, fellas.
I've got a question about the word suicide. But not as it refers to its literal meaning. When I was a little kid, my brother and I would go to a convenience store or a fast food place where you could fill up your own soda. And when you put different types of soda into your glass, that was called a suicide. And I thought that was just something my brother and I said, but I guess it's not. Everybody I know says that. And I was just wondering how that word got attached to doing that.
There is something about the way she conjures the ancestors. She dances when she walks like she's from the Congo. Pure. Convo like Asada Shakur says, brothers don't understand the science behind her self-reliance. She has a tattoo of Noble Drew on her neck and a tattoo of Marcus Garvey on her breast and says you've got to have the presence of Martin Delaney if you ever hope to have a future in getting past her Malcolm X. She is smooth as the Hennessy she's sipping as we listen to Horace Silver playing our third game of chess, and I can't help but stare into the natural texture of her hair as she compares George Padmore with C.L.R. James. And from there, she discusses Rodney's, how Europe underdeveloped Africa, and compares that to Kwame Nkrumah's neocolonialism, the last stage of imperialism. And as her lips move, I get lost in her rhythm. And as her thoughts move, I get lost in her wisdom. I love it when she sings CCY2 to the children. I love it when we go on vacations and she puts that homemade sign on the door that says, do not disturb. Nation building. She is Harriet Tubman, loving her people with a passion, fashion like that last chapter in Carter G. Woodson's Miseducation of the Negro. We go conjure the ancestors after every poetry reading, breathing life into the souls that surround us like New Orleans, constantly calling me back. I bathe her in compliments. I wrap her confidence around my waist. I taste her ancestors' DNA every night because there's something spiritual about swallowing the same fluids that once coursed to the physical forms of her predecessor slaves and tribes. And yo, you might think you know me, but if you ain't never seen me with her, then you ain't never seen me alive. I said, you might think you know me, but if you ain't never seen me with her, then you ain't never seen me alive, because she goes from J.A. Rogers to Abubakar while her heart beats the rhythm of the Haitian Revolution and she dances to it, singing the songs of the Cimarron colonies of San Salvador. And as she moves, there's something about the way she conjures the ancestors. There's something about the way she conjures my soul by day and by night. There is something about the way that she has conjured me back from the dead. There is something about the way that she conjures me continuously back to life.
This is the conspiratorial view of history, as opposed to the accidental view. And it is the conspiratorial view that we shall present in this program.
Virtually none of Thanksgiving has an ounce of accuracy, notes the bestseller Lies My Teacher Told Me. The idea of Europe bringing civilization to the Americas simply flips truth on its head. This is what European explorers actually found in North America.
Far and away the most beautiful city on Earth. Five times the size of London or Rome. Great towers and buildings rising from the water. 60,000 gleaming houses, and how spacious and how well built they were, of beautiful stonework and cedarwood, and the wood of other sweet-scented trees. The many streets and boulevards of the city were so neat and well swept, despite the multitude of inhabitants, crisscrossed with a complex network of canals, like an enormous Venice, but also remarkable floating gardens that reminded of nowhere else on Earth.
While Europe was drinking water from its polluted city rivers, huge aqueducts transported America's water from fresh springs.
But what impressed most were the special merchant areas, where timber and tiles and other building materials were bought and sold, as well as greengrocer streets, where one could buy every sort of vegetable, fruits, honeys, nut paste and chocolates. Astonished by the personal cleanliness and hygiene of the colorfully dressed populace, and by their extravagant use of soaps, deodorants, and breath sweeteners.
Most Europeans never bathed and kept clothes on at all times. The Pilgrims, notes biographer Zini Finer, had a terrible smell. Indians tried, quote, without success, to teach them to bathe. The settlers also had bad breath from rotting teeth. Death and starvation was so common that corpses were just dumped in open pits known as poor holes. Many turned to alcohol and committed suicide. In fact, the story of the first settlers has been deliberately changed, notes author James Lowen, because the truth is so shameful. They actually settled hundreds of miles further south and stayed in America because the mission was a failure. Their real aim, reports historian Robert Beverly, was to find some gold and take it back to Europe.
They spent their days digging random holes in the ground, haplessly looking for gold instead of planting crops. Soon they were starving and digging up putrid Indian corpses to eat. They took some Indian prisoners and forced them to teach the colonists how to farm.
And the meal with the natives wasn't quite the Thanksgiving shown on TV and in school books.
The colonists offered the Indians a toast to eternal friendship, whereupon the chief, his family, advisors, and 200 followers dropped dead of poison.
In mainstream history books, perhaps the most common description of American territory then is virgin land. In fact, notes historian Peter Jennings, it was widowed. Horrific enough, the Nazi ethnic cleansings in Europe during World War II. Leading American studies professor David Stannard notes it's dwarfed by, quote, far and away the most massive act of genocide in the history of the world. The death of 100 million indigenous people in the, quote, American Holocaust. Some from disease, but also vast numbers from a deliberate policy aimed at wiping out the race that mainstream history books continue to pretend never happened. He knows when Heinrich Himmler called the final solution, quote, delousing, Himmler was only echoing the Pilgrim Army's rallying cry, nits make lice, nits being Indian babies. This was a map of Indian nations across the US. 80% of the first government's entire budget went on attacking existing Indian settlements to take their developed farmland. Settlers would most probably not have survived, writes Jennings, on their own. 95% of America's entire population was then wiped out. American Holocaust notes there is documented evidence of colonist leaders going town after town, deliberately killing all men, women, and children. Yet school texts and history books remain silent. Orders came from the very top. Under the direct order of George Washington, at least 28 of 30 Seneca towns and all the towns of the Mohawk, Onondaga, and Cayuga were simply obliterated. George Washington wrote, the Indian country, quote, must be destroyed. Thomas Jefferson called to, quote, pursue Indians to extermination. Nobel Peace Prize winner Theodore Roosevelt called beneficial the eradication of the native race. Stannard notes, genocide was official public policy. California Governor Peter Burnett in his 1851 message to the legislature.
Extermination must continue to be waged until the Indian becomes extinct.
Another governor issued the public proclamation to, quote, pursue, kill, and destroy all Indians. A witness notes the ensuing bloodbath practically wiped out the native race.
The whites shoot them down like wolves, men, women, and children, wherever they could find them. This war of extermination against the Aborigines is tending to the final extinction of the race.
What reportedly saved the race from extinction was their use as slave labor.
This extermination policy has proved so injurious to the interests of the whites. Indian labor is indispensable.
Highly prized slaves were Indian girls as young as three, said the Marysville Appeal, for fulfilling double roles of labor and of lust. Phil Lane Jr.'s hereditary chief of the Hankton One First Nation. Phil, really great to see you. What facts are being airbrushed out of history?
Practices were that sometimes you don't want to speak about. And they not only wiped out most of the people, but the way they did it, the greatest loss of people any time in history.
Cultural genocide is still being waged on surviving Indians, reports Truthell. From the start of the 20th century, children were forced into so-called Indian boarding schools, designed to, quote, kill the Indian in them, according to the system's founding father, Richard Pratt. Indians are obliged to change their name to a Western one like Tom, made to dress and style their hair like whites. Indigenous Americans are also forced to adopt Christianity and all other parts of Western culture. Lenore Stiffarm witnessed the abuse firsthand. Thank you so much for speaking to us. Can you tell us what happened?
Federal policy here was to take the Indian out of the person. They beat the language out of like my father. He grew up his whole life. His hands were kind of bent. As a result, he used to talk our native language, but he never wanted me to learn. I consider myself a recovering Catholic because of, you know, the sexual abuse that I experienced, you know, from the Catholic Church.
Daniel Sheehan says the genocide is continuing. He's helped start the Lakota Child Rescue Project to stop the forcible removal of Indian children. Daniel, thanks a lot for coming on. Could you tell us what is happening to the children?
And what we discovered is that not only were the children being taken on an epidemic level, that it was happening on every single one of the reservations and in virtually every one of the major cities. The International Convention Against Genocide actually has a provision which expressly identifies what's going on as genocide, that the systematic undertaking on the part of the racially dominant culture in a given nation state, taking away indigenous children from their native tribes and putting them in the white culture, has been identified as genocide.
Even the Supreme Court still upholds natives' second-class status to this day, writes noted legal scholar Robert Williams. He joins us now. It's really great to speak to you. Can you give us some examples?
One out of three Indian women will be raped during their lifetime. In 86% of those cases, the victims report that it's a non-Indian that perpetuated the sexual assault or the rape. This has been traced directly to the inability of tribes to prosecute these crimes. One of the points I make in my book, Savage Anxieties, is that if you look at the history of the more civilized nations' treatments, so-called more civilized nations' treatments of indigenous peoples, it really makes you wonder who are the savages and who are the more civilized. One very famous study done found that every single treaty that the United States had negotiated with tribes had in fact been breached at one time or another, or had been violated. Supreme Court said they had no property rights and therefore no rights to just compensation. And there was some horrible language in the opinion about how the court recognized that everyone knows that the savage tribes of America were conquered and the treaties were really meaningless anyway. So it's this perpetuation of these stereotypes in this case, which is still valid law in the United States. It's still a valid precedent.
And so they drink it, but it's actually hairspray.
Native Indians now have the highest rate of suicide and pandemics of cancer in the Western Hemisphere. At 44, life expectancy is lower than Afghanistan and around the same as Europe at the time of the Pilgrims. For an official banquet to celebrate 350 years since Pilgrims landed, authorities invited Native Indian Frank James to speak. But when they saw his speech taken from a settler's own account of what really happened, they wouldn't let him read it.
The Pilgrims had hardly explored the shores 4 days before they robbed the graves of my ancestors and stole their corn, wheat, and beans. The Indians knew this fact, yet welcomed and befriended the settlers, little knowing that they would be killed by the settlers' guns. What has happened cannot be changed, but today we work toward a better America, a more Indian America, where people and nature are once again important.
Frank has helped start a national day of mourning each Thanksgiving, a protest over the Plymouth Harbor and Mayflower replica. On the West Coast, thousands also gather for Un-Thanksgiving Day, calling on the U.S. to honor treaties promising Indian rights and international law. The American government faces increasing domestic and international pressure. Supreme Court has reaffirmed the validity of the Treaty of Fort Laramie, giving Indians rights over the area. The United Nations, despite four countries voting against, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and the United States, passed a resolution declaring indigenous peoples' right to self-rule. The UN is also calling for the states to return to Indian tribes their stolen land. The Mexica movement wants to bring indigenous people of America in a single nation without, it says, the artificial borders created by Europeans. Movement's director, Olentzeska Lepoka, joins us. Really great to see you. You say the demographics are on your side.
We are projected to be the majority in the states of California and Arizona, and basically the Western United States. In the next 50 years, we're going to be the majority in the United States of America. For the European who's scared about all this, I'd say pull a seat over, because that's what we've been doing for 500 years. We've been scared of all of the monstrosities that Europeans have done to us. They've exterminated 95% of our population. They've stolen 100% of our land. They've left us in poverty on our own land.
Many cities throughout the U.S. are already majority indigenous. In 8 years, 8 more states are projected to be white minority. In 30 years, that will apply to the United States as a whole. The reaction of certain Americans is already causing some surprise.
Hi, everybody. On behalf of all the Obamas, Michelle, Malia, Sasha, Beau, and the newest member of our family, Sonny, I want to wish you a happy and healthy Thanksgiving. We'll be spending today just like many of you, sitting down with family and friends to eat some good food, tell some stories, watch a little football, and most importantly, count our blessings. And as Americans, we have so much to be thankful for. We give thanks for the men and women who set sail for this land nearly 4 centuries ago, risking everything for the chance at a better life, and the people who are already here, our Native American brothers and sisters, for their generosity during that first Thanksgiving. We give thanks for the generations who followed, people of all races and religions, who arrived here from every country on earth and worked to build something better for themselves and for us. We give thanks for all our men and women in uniform, and for their families, who are surely missing them very much today. We're grateful for their sacrifice, too. We give thanks for the freedoms they defend, the freedom to think what we want and say what we think, to worship according to our own beliefs, to choose our leaders and, yes, criticize them without punishment. People around the world are fighting and even dying for their chance at these freedoms. We stand with them in that struggle, and we give thanks for being free. We give thanks to everyone who's doing their part to make the United States a better, more compassionate nation, who spend their Thanksgiving volunteering at a soup kitchen, or joining a service project, or bringing food and cheer to a lonely neighbor. That big-hearted generosity is a central part of our American character. We believe in lending a hand to folks who need it. We believe in pitching in to solve problems, even if they aren't our problems. And that's not a one-day-a-year belief. It's part of the fabric of our nation. And we remember that many Americans need that helping hand right now. Americans who've lost their jobs and can't get a new one through no fault of their own. Americans who've been trapped in poverty and just need that helping hand to climb out. Citizens whose prayers and hopes move us to act. We're a people who are greater together than we are on our own. And that's what today is all about. That's what every day should be about. No matter what our differences, we're all part of one American family. We're each other's keepers. We are one nation under God. That core tenet of our American experience has guided us from the earliest days of our founding, and it will guide us to a future that's even brighter than today. Thank you, God bless you, and from my family to yours, happy Thanksgiving.
About no Thanksgiving at the park. Church members wanting to do a good deed by simply feeding the homeless instead are told to leave. Tonight, CBS 12 goes searching for answers.
You have to take your questions to the administration building.
Are you the one that told these people to leave? Good evening, everyone, and thank you for joining us tonight. I'm John DiCepolo. Happy Thanksgiving to all, but apparently not for the homeless, at least the ones living at John Prince Park in Lake Worth. Today is a day to think of others, which is exactly what some Christian folks wanted to do. But when the church group tried to deliver food to those in need, they were ordered to stop by a park ranger. Tonight, in a CBS 12 News exclusive, Israel Balderas tried to ask one simple question. Why can't the homeless be fed at a public park?
God takes care of us, you know. We don't starve. We're grateful.
Stephen Griffin and his wife Dominique are homeless. John Prince Park in Lake Worth is their home, and they're not the only ones. That's why a dozen church members...
I do whatever I can.
Like Teresa Del Rio from Acts 2 Worship Center in Loxahatchee, showed up with packaged Thanksgiving meals.
We brought our kids out here so they could see what it's really like for people that are struggling.
We do a lot of mission trips and helping the homeless and stuff like that.
And this act of kindness was greatly appreciated.
We're grateful, you know, they hand out, we meet the guys and stuff, you know, they give us a prayer and everything.
But then, just as the homeless like Kevin were being fed, a Palm Beach County park ranger comes up to the church group and orders them to stop and leave.
Shoplifters are now under arrest after a wild chase that ended in gunfire at a Kohl's department store outside of Chicago. This happened on Thanksgiving night. Police officers chased the suspects into the parking lot, where one officer got caught in a getaway car after a struggle. The driver then took off, dragging the cop across the parking lot. The second officer fired into the car, hitting the driver and stopping the car. A third suspect was found inside the store. The officer and suspect were treated at a local hospital.
When it came to Black Friday, Seattle crowds were tamer than shoppers across the country.
Hold up. You're pushing me.
Yeah, things got ugly. Employees at this Walmart in Georgia couldn't escape an onslaught of shoppers desperate to get their hands on $40 tablets. Meanwhile, a police officer inside this Walmart in Odessa, Texas, fired off pepper spray when crowds became too wild, trying to get their hands on tablets and headphones.
Million Americans traveling this holiday season, the FAA has issued a reminder that any plane can crash and kill you. Deputy FAA Administrator Serena Grant spoke this morning.
This year, there will be more flights than ever, and any one of them could blow up in the middle of the sky without warning. That's why we're asking all Americans to tell their families that they love them before taking off.
To make holiday travel smoother, the FAA recommends getting to the airport 2 hours early to give you plenty of time to pray to your God or gods, think on your sins, and consider what it feels like to die. The agency also released a list of important questions to ask yourself or your seatmate during your flight, including, should the wing be doing that? What is that whirring noise? And do all planes shake this much? They're reminding passengers that even the smallest amount of turbulence could mean you're headed toward a sudden explosive death.
There are hundreds of people who work to assure the safety of every flight. So if even one of them makes a mistake, the cabin could rip open and you could get sucked out of the plane and into one of the engines.
Travelers are already taking the FAA's tips to heart.
I travel all the time, so I am always ready to die. I actually brought the FAA-recommended picture of my children to stare at tearfully as the plane careens into the side of a mountain.
While hurtling through the sky at unimaginable speeds in a steel coffin can feel like gambling with your life, the FAA says there are ways to regain the illusion of control.
If you're worried about crashing, why not switch your flight at the last second? It might just save your life. Or kill you, depending on which plane crashes.
And for those who aren't flying this holiday, the FAA has reminded everyone that a plane could fall out of the sky right on top of you at any moment.
Humans are very good at noticing sudden changes. Like if you get punched in the face or if a flood comes sweeping down your street, you almost definitely notice unless you're deep into a crossword puzzle trying to figure out a 14-letter word for a foul-mouthed Parisian's motto, in which case you may find yourself surfing down the street with dogs and trees and cars and shit, going, "Pardon my French! Pardon my French! I should have gotten that one!" Anyway, point is, we're generally pretty good at noticing sudden changes. We're not good at noticing subtle changes. We're terrible at it. This is one reason things like police militarization have grown largely unchecked. The police didn't transform overnight from Johnny on the beat with only a nightstick to Rambo gonna beat your head in with an assault rifle. If only I could find someone to scratch my shoulder for me first. Because this massive bicep is making it difficult to do standard human maneuvers. Please, someone help. No, that change was done gradually, over decades. Because large groups of people generally habituate to the new normal. The next generation accepts a new baseline. Corporations didn't stick their greed pole up our collective ass all in one foul thrust. Otherwise, we would have gone, "Whoa! Hey! Easy with the pole!" No, they did it slowly, over years and years. And now kids that are teenagers today just think it's normal to have 6 or 8 corporations controlling almost everything we buy, touch, breathe, or finger. You can go down the list and look at how important it is for these changes to happen gradually, even if it's only over a few years. And then, if there does come a moment when the American people start to say, "Hey! You can't listen to our phone calls!" The corporatocracy will go, "We've been doing it for years. Nothing is changing." They said that with indefinite detention of American citizens, and with torture, and hydrofracking, and many other intrusions. "We've been breaking this law for years and years, alright? All we're doing now is codifying it. And I know that's a big word, but I tell you what, you don't worry your little head about it. You just go take a nappy poo, and you feel better in the morning." Habituation is also the reason we're unable to deal with climate change in the slightest. Because our downfall is happening in slow motion, it doesn't seem to matter that it's right in front of us. We'll deal with the tornado that is coming towards us at that moment. "Everybody down in the basement! Bring the dog I like! Leave the yappy one out in the yard." Yeah, leave him. But we won't deal with the larger, slower, more powerful issue that is causing the increase in tornadoes or flooding or drought. And now the authorities are using this technique to slowly criminalize dissent. A peaceful activist named Reverend Billy is facing a year in jail for dancing and speaking inside a Chase bank in order to call attention to the bank's contribution to environmental destruction. Many people are not even shocked by this because they've accepted the slow criminalization of protest. Could you imagine if a man gets locked away for singing and dancing inside a bank while no one at J.P. Morgan Chase sees prison time for the complete and utter ransacking of the U.S. economy and homeowners across the nation? What would it say about us if we stand by and accept that as the new normal? If we're not willing to stand up against this shit show of a corporatized kangaroo court, then what the fuck are we willing to stand up against? And I apologize to the kangaroo for dragging their adorable, ridiculous asses into this discussion. They did nothing wrong but hop around, and here we are relating them to our travesty of a tragedy, our hysterically cynical criminal judicial system. But then again, maybe the kangaroos aren't as innocent as they look. They do hop around, and if you do that inside a Chase bank, you might get a year in jail.
In the 1800s, society sanctioned both approaches to healing. Patients had a choice of using either doctors called allopaths or natural healers called empirics or homeopaths. The two groups waged a bitter philosophical debate. The allopathic doctors called their approach heroic medicine. They believed the physician must aggressively drive disease from the body. They based their practice on what they considered scientific theory. The allopaths used 3 main techniques. They bled the body to drain out the bad humors. They gave huge doses of toxic minerals like mercury and lead to displace the original disease. They also used surgery, but it was a brutal procedure before anesthesia and infection control. Few patients were willing to have surgery. Most patients feared allopathic methods altogether. satirist of the day remarked that with allopathic treatment, the patient died of the cure. Competing with the doctors were the empiric healers. Contrary to the doctors, they believed in stimulating the body's own defenses to heal itself. Instead of poisonous minerals, they used vegetable products and non-toxic substances in small quantities. They especially favored herbs learned from Native American and old European traditions. The empirics said they based their remedies not on theory, but on observation and experience. Satirist of the day added that with empiric treatment, the patient died of the disease, not the cure. In the 1800s, doctors tried to stop the popular empirics from collecting their fees by denouncing them as quacks. Economic competition from the empiric healers caused the doctors to found the American Medical Association. But the AMA was a small trade association without political clout, and the balance of medical power remained equal until the turn of the century. Then new medical treatments emerged that were potentially very profitable. Promoting these methods, the AMA joined with strong financial forces to transform medicine into an industry. The fortunes of Carnegie, Morgan, and Rockefeller financed surgery, radiation, and synthetic drugs. They were to become the economic foundations of the new medical economy. Ironically, John D. Rockefeller himself used only an empiric homeopath while investing in allopathic medicine. Surgery became viable with anesthesia and infection control, and doctors advocated expensive, radical operations. These in turn produced the need for a large, lucrative hospital system. The allopaths also discovered a new toxic mineral, radium. Radium fever swept medicine. The price of radium rose 1,000% almost overnight. Another costly technological industry entered the hospital system. A drug industry grew out of the booming patent medicine business. Ironically, many of the new synthetic drugs came from plants and empiric remedies. Drug company ads boosted the revenues of the AMA Journal 500% in 10 years. The doctors changed educational standards and licensing regulations to exclude the empirics. Soon, only AMA-approved doctors could legally practice medicine. In a brief 20 years, the AMA came to dominate medical practice. Organized Medicine launched a media campaign to associate the empirics with quacks. The code word for competition was quackery. By the 1940s, its quack files had swelled to include 300,000 names. The Fitzgerald Report to Congress named at least a dozen other promising cancer treatments seemingly blocked by organized medicine. Their proponents were mostly doctors and scientists of high reputation. The treatments were immunological or nutritional. Dismissing them as quackery were panels of surgeons and radiation therapists. The congressional report emphasized two outstanding cases of alleged suppression, Harry Hoxie and Dr. Andrew C. Ivey. If Hoxie fit the image of a quack, Dr. Ivey certainly did not. The similarity of Dr. Ivey's charges to those of Hoxie was unmistakable, a failed attempt by an AMA official to buy his formulas, followed by blackballing and a refusal to test the therapy. The Fitzgerald Report to Congress described a menacing pattern.
Fitzgerald concluded in his report, quote, "Behind this is the weirdest conglomeration of corrupt motives, intrigue, selfishness, jealousy, obstruction, and conspiracy that I have ever seen."
Despite its shocking conclusions, the Fitzgerald Report slipped quietly into the appendix of the Congressional Record. With Dr. Ivey's death, Krebiosyn would vanish, untested. At the height of the McCarthy era, a dozen other promising treatments would be banned without investigation.
An Amish family in Ohio says their 11-year-old daughter is now cancer-free after they halted her chemo treatments and used alternative medicine instead.
The family is currently in hiding at this point. They've been in a legal battle with a hospital over the girl's cancer treatment for years now.
Earlier this month, a court appointed a nurse to make medical decisions as the girl's guardian, but the family had already fled their home and reportedly sought alternative cancer treatments in Central America. CNN's Nick Valencia has spoken to the family's lawyer. Nick, how do we really know at this point that she's really cancer-free?
We don't, and as you mentioned, it's because the family is in hiding, so there's no real way for the doctors at Akron's Children's Hospital to confirm if she is indeed cancer-free. Now, I spoke to the lawyer yesterday. He says that this little girl, Sarah, has undergone several CAT scans that shows little to no evidence of cancer. And when I spoke to Maurice Thompson, the attorney, he said this really isn't about whether or not the family's going to refuse chemotherapy. They say they're not ruling it out. They just don't want it as a first resort option. And he says this case comes down to one simple thing.
I think the most important principle at stake here really is not just the constitutional right, but the moral right to refuse conventional medical treatments that carry their own risks that may be as great as the harm from the disease itself. It's really about the right of parents to keep their family together and for parents to control their family rather than for government to control their family and for individuals to control their health care decisions.
And the doctors say at Akron's Children's Hospital, if she doesn't get treated soon, there's a strong chance she will die. They also say that she has an 85% survival rate if she goes down chemotherapy. And the last chemo treatment she got was in June, so several months ago, 5 months ago.
Okay, what's the hospital saying beyond that? Are they anything more about what's happening?
One of the questions is if it's because this family is Amish, and that's a question posed to the hospital. And they said, the chief medical officer said, no, we have 10 Amish kids that we're treating right now. This is about a family's personal decision to decide whether or not they want to pursue chemotherapy. They, you know, the lawyer says that this is about their option of what kind of health care they want to give the child. Earlier this summer, the chief medical officer for Akron's Children's Hospital talked to us about how we sort of got into this situation.
And the child did have some side effects, which would be certainly expected. And then the decision initially was they wanted to have additional complementary medicine, which is something that we would certainly be supportive of. And then the decision shifted that it would be only using the alternative medicine or the herbal medicine.
So doctors say they want to help, but the family wants to pursue another path first.
Well, it's a celestial smackdown in South Florida. An out-of-this-world encounter with space rocks. A 7-year-old boy was playing in his driveway Saturday when something fell on his head. The gash required 3 staples. His father searched the area and found rock fragments. He took them to Florida Atlantic University for testing, where researchers determined they had all the elements of being meteorites. The rare rocks will need more chemical testing to confirm that's what they are.
Catch a falling star and put it in your pocket, never let it fade away. Catch a falling star and put it in your pocket, save it for a rainy day. For love may come and tap you on the shoulder some starless night. Just in case you feel you wanna hold her, you'll have a pocket full of starlight.
Beyond the turkey, eating it, I mean, have you heard about Comet Ison? It has been coming our way for 1 million years now. It is here. This is time-lapse video from NASA. And tomorrow, while you're eating said turkey, or whatever you so choose, it will fly perilously closely around the sun. If it survives, it could be an awesome, awesome sight for us, Chad Myers.
Yes.
If it survives this close encounter with the sun.
I know. And it had a coronal mass ejection whack it the other day, too.
Darn that coronal mass ejection.
I know, ejections. And it blasted some dust off of this thing. It's about the size of a shopping center. And okay. It's made of ice and junk, and it's flying around the sun. Okay. And it's going to get bright. And it could be very close. It could be the coolest thing around Christmas if it survives. But it's ice going to the sun. You know, that's
two things. Not a good mix.
That's probably not the best thing you could do. You want to go around maybe Saturn. It's colder out there.
Yeah.
So it's going to go, as it goes by, tomorrow morning, wake up before sunrise, look to the east, you may be able to see it as it flares coming out. It kind of looks like that. There's Comet Ison over there. That's what it's looked like from space telescopes. It has to fly around the sun. If it makes its way around the sun and it survives and it comes out the other side, all of a sudden in December, it's going to be really, really amazing. As it comes out, we'll be able to see it at sunset. You'll be able to see it at sunrise, and it's going to be maybe the comet of the century, but others are saying, I don't think it's going to make it. It could be two or three breakup, and it could be a dud.
So tomorrow before sunrise, little something, but, you know, fingers crossed, we could be seeing something pretty spectacular around Christmas.
Right. Okay. Tomorrow and the next couple days could be great, but after that just could be stunning.
Catch a falling star and put it in your pocket. Never let it fade away.
Never let it fade away.
Catch a falling star and put it in your pocket. Save it for a rainy day.
Save it for a rainy day.
For love may come and tap you on the shoulder some starless night. And just in case you feel you want to hold her, you'll have a pocket full of starlight.
Pocket full of starlight.
Astronomers monitoring the progress of a potential comet of the century say the next 24 hours could be its most crucial time. Comet Ison is making its closest approach to the sun. If it survives intact, it could give stargazers an astronomical treat. However, scientists fear it might break up. Our science correspondent Rebecca Morrell has the story.
A dazzling visitor from deepest space. The approach of Comet Ison has been avidly watched by astronomers. But now this huge ball of ice and rock is entering the solar danger zone. This comet has been on an epic journey. It began at the very edge of our solar system and has been hurtling towards us at more than a million kilometers an hour, passing the planets, including our own. Now it's looping around the sun, but will it survive?
Catch a falling star and put it in your pocket. Never let it fade away. Catch a falling star and put it in your pocket. Save it for a rainy day.
Save it for a rainy day.
For when your troubles start multiplying, and they just might, it's easy to forget them without trying. With just a pocket full of starlight.
Ison might follow the path of another comet called Lovejoy. In 2011, as it raced towards the sun, the intense gravitational field and fierce heat ripped it apart. But Ison's large size could protect it. The heat could ignite the dust and gas in its core, allowing it to blaze a trail across the night skies. It would be visible in the northern hemisphere in early December.
At the optimistic end, it's visible to the naked eye that if you get a pair of binoculars, you can see both the comet's head, the coma, and a nice long tail coming from that. That would be a really good comet. It'll be a comet if it's like that, that you have to get up early in the morning to see, but nonetheless, it would be a pretty good one by the standards of these things.
This close encounter is a chance to study one of the oldest objects in our solar system up close, and space telescopes are trained on the comet. But these recent NASA images suggest Ison is buckling under the heat. Stargazers will have to wait to find out if it lives up to its billing as the comet of the century.
Catch a falling star and put it in your pocket. Never let it fade away. Catch a falling star and put it in your pocket. Save it for a rainy day.
Save it for a rainy day.
Save it for a rainy day.
Archaeologists have discovered the remains of an ancient settlement which could be as much as 10,000 years old. The site was accidentally discovered in lowland in south-central Israel during works to widen a motorway. Archaeologist Amir Golani.
People lived here over 5,000 years ago, not only in this building, but in many, many buildings next to them. And all these buildings form a complete plan. In this plan, okay, we see the beginnings of how society moved from being a village-centered society to an urban-centered society.
Among the discovery, a rare cluster of axes and a stone column, which archaeologists believe could be part of a temple.
And so here at Eshta'ol, we have found several buildings, and amongst them we found a very interesting and large stone. A very large stone, I would say, worked on all six sides, like a domino. Standing upright as a standing stone, this stone, we believe, served a cultic function. And we believe during the Chalcolithic period, which is 4,500 to 3,800 BCE, there apparently was a cultic center here and or a temple.
Officials say the discoveries provide a broad picture of human development over thousands of years.
Now, just a short while ago, China launched its Chang'e 3 lunar probe called the Jade Rabbit. This is the very moment of countdown to liftoff.
3, 2, 1, 点火, 点火.
It is China's first attempt to land a spacecraft on the moon, which is scheduled to land in mid-December. And if all goes to plan, it will be the first moon landing in more than 40 years. China says it will carry out research and prepare the way forward for manned missions, which may seek to exploit the moon's natural resources.
Very powerful stuff. What more do you want?
In this universe, there is one great energy, and we have no name for it. People have tried various names for it, like God, like Brahman, like Tao. But in the West, the word God has got so many funny associations attached to it that most of us are bored with it. When people say God the Father Almighty, most people feel funny inside. But according to Buddhist philosophy, all this universe is one tatata. That means 10,000 functions or 10,000 things, one suchness. And we're all one suchness. And that means that suchness comes and goes like everything else, because this whole world is an on and off system. As the Chinese say, it's the yang and the yin. And therefore it consists of now you see it, now you don't, here you are, here you aren't, here you aren't. Because that's the very nature of energy, to be like waves, and waves have crests and troughs. Only, we, being under a certain kind of sleepiness or illusion, imagine that the trough is going to overcome the wave or the crest. The yin, the dark principle, is going to overcome the yang or the light principle. And that off is finally going to triumph over on. And we, shall I say, bug ourselves by indulging in that illusion. Gee, supposing darkness did win out, wouldn't that be terrible? And so we're constantly trembling and thinking that it may, because after all, isn't it odd that anything exists? It's most peculiar. It requires effort, it requires energy, and it would be so much easier for there to have been nothing at all. Therefore we think, well, since being, since the is side of things is so much effort, you always give up after a while and you sink back into death. But death is just the other face of energy. And it's the rest, the not being anything around, that produces something around, just in the same way that you can't have solid without space, or space without solid. When you wake up to this, and realize that the more it changes, the more it's the same thing, as the French say, that you are really a playing of this one energy, and there is nothing else but that, that it is you, but that for you to be always you would be an insufferable bore. And therefore, it is arranged that you stop being you after a while, and then come back as someone else altogether. And so when you find that out, you become full of energy and delight. And you suddenly see through the whole sham of things. You realize you're that. We won't put a name on it. You're that. And you can't be anything else. So you are relieved of fundamental terror. That doesn't mean that you're always going to be a great hero, that you won't jump when you hear it bang, that you won't worry occasionally, that you won't lose your temper. It means, though, that fundamentally, deep, deep down within you, you will be able to be human in the pains, difficulties, and struggles that naturally go with human existence. But to have no hang-up, that is to say, to be able to drift like a cloud and flow like water, seeing that all life is a magnificent illusion, a playing of energy, and there is absolutely nothing fundamentally to be afraid of. Fundamentally. You will be afraid on the surface. You will be afraid of putting your hand in the fire. You will be afraid of getting sick. But you will not be afraid of fear. Fear will pass over your mind like a black cloud will be reflected in the mirror.
Now, go find the others.com.
Yeah, man, I tell you what, that dang old internet, man, you just go on there and point and click, 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 click. It's real easy, man.